This episode of AVXL was recorded on July 21st, 2017. But wait, so was last week's, so keep listening, because we have an incredible dog pile of viewer questions. It's Question-O-Rama this week on AVXL.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. And ladies and gentlemen, we are pre-recording this episode because I, Patrick Norton, am somewhere in the Sierra Nevada right now. Or perhaps freshly returned from Camp Mather in the beautiful Sierra Nevada.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited.
Get outside.
It's really crazy. Along with filling what some people said was a valley more beautiful than Yosemite to create the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir that feeds crystal clear, pure mountain water.
The cold stuff.
To the city and county of San Francisco and various other local areas. They ended up with another 370 acres, I guess, which was used to provide lumber for the Hetch Hetchy project. Uh-huh. Then San Francisco turned that into basically a place for San Franciscans to get away from San Francisco. And some friends of ours got a campsite in the lottery, so I'm going to be at camp.
Nice.
With several hundred other people I've never met before.
Oh, that's okay.
It's either going to be great or it's going to be, you know, like my first cruise ship experience.
Bring a hammock. It's all about the hammock experience.
Books.
Sleeping in a dangling bag.
There will be
in
books.
Nature.
Oh, my goodness.
It's awesome.
Which was laughing. There was a sort of a large crazed thread on Twitter where basically I was, amongst other things, calling out Tidal because I'm really irritated. If I pay $20 a month for Lossless, I think it's just unnecessary to do pop-up ads I have to close before I can listen to music.
A little.
This has been irritating me for a while, but, you know.
Usually you pay to get rid of the ads.
During Jay-Z week.
Or at least in the middle of you listening.
Yeah, well.
I can take an ad when it's just sitting there, but.
You know, there's a thin line. I mean, you know, man. I mean, you know, Jay-Z's 444 basically took over Tidal for a week.
Gotcha.
And that was when I realized that, you know.
It's an amazing album. Haven't listened to the whole thing yet, though.
I know, but it's funny because, like, I love Tidal. I really do. There's, you know, I love the fact that it's streaming lossless. You know, I love the way they've integrated that into Rune Audio. And I love using it via Rune Audio because Rune Audio's interface is so much better than Tidal's interface. But I was laughing because...
It's nice you have those options, though.
Yeah. I mean, 444, amazing album. No argument.
Okay.
But I'm also laughing because a few weeks before that, I was looking at the recommendations on the front page. And it's obviously, it's one of those moments where it's like, well, whatever we're marketing this week.
Yeah, it's not really personalized.
No, I mean, especially because you look at Spotify, you know, and Spotify does, you know, lists, like what they call the discovery. And they put a playlist together for each and every week. And it's like, I've found some amazing stuff on there.
Probably some serious machine learning.
Probably some serious
on the back end
learning,
of you know. Spotify's
yeah, and
doings.
Well, instead of serious machine learning, Tidal's got, you know, the intern in the marketing department, like, you know, what obscure artist can we throw up on here next to a bunch of not obscure artists that are paying significant marketing dollars?
You will like this. Enjoy.
No, I will not. But, yeah, just a random
smile,
thought there.
Smile.
I bring all that up because of the tail end of my ranting about Tidal. And, you know, and Tidal's losing money hand over fist, much like Spotify and every other online streaming music service, it seems like, these days. So, you know, this may be a problem that goes away because they can't make money.
Potential is there.
At Blue Man tweets, what is your travel audio setup? And, you know, I was laughing because, you know, I have my 30-pound knapsack. And, you know, invariably in my 30-pound knapsack, at the very least, is a set of... basically, my daily drivers, which is the AudioQuest Nighthawks or Night Owls.
Okay, you're bringing the good guns
and the one more triple driver.
Those are handy to have on. I keep those in my backpack when
you know,
I travel.
An Astell and Kern, and often for reasons I don't understand, a FiO X1 because you know everybody needs to have two FLAC players in their bag.
Yeah, when I'm traveling, it's pretty much just my phone with FLAC files, and I'll just tolerate my DAC built into my phone, which is nothing special.
Most of my listening is when I'm traveling. A lot of it's not on the phone, but I also enjoy having, like, being able to not have, because all too often when I'm listening with my phone, the phone is wanting to tell me things. You know, Poughkeepsie is on fire.
Right.
You know, your mom just sent you an email. Oh, look, there's you know what I mean? Like the whole notifications thing on the phone.
That's, you know, airplane mode.
Yeah. I know, but it's...
I hear you.
It's a thin line between...
Having a dedicated device eliminates distraction.
Yes.
That's very true.
And the audio is really, 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 really good.
I'll be honest. Most of the time, if I'm flying, I don't listen to anything. I'll either just leave the earbuds in just to make it look like I'm asleep and leave me alone.
Right.
Don't bother me for food.
Well, you've done that when we've shared hotel rooms.
Or earplugs. I just have a whole carton of really good earplugs, and I'll travel with those. But...
Yeah.
And then the content, whatever content I'm rolling with, I have a couple of movies and stuff. Well, for AV, well, if we're talking the video side of it, I've become quite enamored with Netflix's ability to download certain titles, at least, and load up your device.
Not enough.
Load it up and bring that with you on a flight. And that can save you a few bucks or just give you some content you want to see, not the edited for airplane version of...
Edited for people who are easily offended by things that offend easily offended people.
Let's just chop it up. Hugging a stranger in the Alps? Was that it? No, I don't know.
I still think the funniest thing I've ever seen was the family-friendly cut of Caddyshack.
Oh, that's
for just... it was like, you know, the Family Channel. It was some sort
of
9-year-old friendly cable television channel.
What are you doing?
Well, it was the funniest part.
Heresy!
The very last scene, you know, where instead of, hey, everybody, we're going to get laid, it's, hey, everybody, we're going to have a party. And the timing was up because they'd obviously cut the... Oh, man.
I can't stand that kind of crap.
No, there's not a lot to... Not a lot.
But a travel audio setup. I will say the only other thing, if I'm road tripping it, that brings some more options and more crap I'm willing to bring. And I'll throw in... God, I still have... My Riva Audio products, wireless Bluetooth speaker, is just handy as heck.
Yeah.
And it's going to give me better audio quality than instant satisfaction just for wherever I'm at, be it at the beach, in a hotel room, whatever.
My problem is usually when I'm traveling for business, the only time I'm going to have time to listen to music is like after midnight in the hotel room.
Right.
I don't want to be that guy playing Rage Against the Machine on.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. I'm not looking to disrupt my neighbors, but at the same point.
Sometimes we are, but only because they've earned it.
And I have enough streaming sources of fun on my phone, I think, at this point, too, to make that just something I can get by with. It's good enough.
If I have to travel light, I just take the in-ears, the one more triple drivers. I do not travel with noise-canceling headphones because they make me feel like my head's about to collapse.
That is an interesting sensation.
I experience that sensation,
and I'd rather, if it's just for sound dampening, I'd rather just wear regular earplugs.
Yeah.
This is true.
Yeah, it was funny. A couple years ago, I kind of lost my mind on eBay, and I got a... headroom, I want to say Cosmo headphone amplifier, which was one of their early huge portable
something to properly drive those Nighthawks.
No, I've never actually plugged the Nighthawks into those.
Okay.
I'm on the headphone.com wedge page, which is Headroom's webpage, and it was funny because what kind of directly led to the Nighthawks was my long suffering headroom headphone amplifier starting to have some issues, and I'm not going to go into that quarter, but here it is. I don't know if it was a Cosmic or a Supreme, but it was like, you know, 15 years ago, it was like the amplifier I so desperately wanted.
Are you talking something portable?
Portable, yeah.
Okay.
There it is, the set. Yeah, this one was, okay, the Supreme, I think it was the second revision from like 1995 or 1999. Yeah, the standard Supreme, premium and Jelly Bean amps. These are like some of the first headphone amplifiers ever built. And, you know, they discontinued these, I want to say in like 99-ish. There was one. It was a headphone amplifier. You know, Till Hertzens, who runs InterFidelity, was one of the first people to really sort of be super enthusiastic about high end listening. Right. This is after, you know, Grado's out with the SR60s and SR80s, and they're working the way up. Sennheiser's 600, which is he has a great article explaining why the Sennheiser 600 is such an important headphone and the evolution of headphone enthusiasm. But I had had a Headroom Little that a friend of mine got me as a Christmas present. That was discontinued back in 1999. But I was laughing, like, I got the portable, you know, I for like $50 on eBay, I got the portable headphone listening system of my dreams, which was like, you know, it was, I think it was a headphone, it was a Headroom like Supreme or Cosmo, and in a portable bag that was custom made for them, and it has a big red plastic box that you put a whole bunch of D cells into because it was the only way they could get the power back then because nobody was using lithium ion batteries. You know, it predates their Airhead, which is a fantastic, you know, one of the first really small. The Airhead and the Total Airhead were really amazing because they were, you know, the size of a pack of cigarettes, the size of a an iPod.
If I'm looking to bump up the audio quality on my travel gear, I'll sometimes bring the 1/8-inch mini jack extension cable and use that with my phone compared to a Bluetooth link if there's an input audio input on the playback device.
Right.
That generally will always sound better than any wireless link. It's usually very noticeable if your ears are doing it. That's something else too, just for a quick, hey, how can I just 10% this better real fast? It's like, yeah, don't do the wireless link. Actually just hardwire the thing.
Yeah. But it, yeah, I mean, I was laughing cause like I got the travel headphone rig of my dreams.
Right.
From 20 years ago for like $50, you know, would have been like $1,000 20 years ago. And I got it for like $50.
Nice.
On
I'm having
eBay
a similar experience with a CPU, actually, for my current workstation. I found, like, the best CPU from circa, I'm not even going to say when the system was originally built, but I could get, like, the most high-end part, which originally sold for, like, $1,500, $2,000, I forget what, back in the day for, like, $50. So I was like, you know what? The socket works.
Don't fix it.
Yeah, you know, everything's working. Why am I willing to rip out the guts for to put in something 7-8 years old? Anyway,
as somebody who's built three different systems in the last year and a half, you know, if you can avoid it,
I'm telling you, I really don't have a desire to remove the heatsink. So it's a massive doohickey.
Oh my goodness, CD is coming up in September. Rocky Mountain Audio Jam.
Oh yeah,
Rocky Mountain Audio Fest is coming
like
up in
Cedia.
October. How would you explain Cedia to somebody who's never been to or heard of Cedia?
I think the acronym itself is pretty good. The what is it? Consumer Electronics Design and Installation Association. Mm-hmm. So, not only do you have folks like the manufacturers showing up to this trade show style event with their new products, typically the projector folks pay a lot of attention or bring their new gear to show off in a way where it's not as TV centric as something like CES is. And then in addition to the manufacturers, you also have the supporting companies. Again, they're manufacturers too, but making, say, accessories like screens or cables or you name it. And then the people who actually install this stuff, and in which case the training that goes along with that at Cedia is, I mean, you can explore. You can go down whatever rabbit hole you want and get some quality training time with the folks who are actually doing it. And it's all pretty darn affordable, too. So it's like a kind of an all-in-one for everything from home automation to home theater to, you know, parts and accessories. And occasionally they sneak in some cool technology demos, too. So yeah, it's always a good show for that.
It's the CES for installers.
It's not as crazy. Yeah, it's not as crazy as some of the larger trade shows, too. So it's a nice quick hit.
One of the things that's supposed to show up at CD 2017 is Emotiva's new flagship 16-channel AV processor. And they're going to be doing like a 7.4.4 Dolby Atmos and DTS:X 3D immersive audio system run by the RMC-1.
Going to be nice.
Yeah, 7.4.4, which basically means 7 surround sound speakers, 4 subwoofers, and 4 Atmos speakers. So,
holy cow.
Yeah, I wonder what their sources are going to be on that.
7.4.4. More subs.
More subs. Alex G's got a question about file sizes when archiving Blu-ray movies. He writes, "Hi, Robert. I'm finally getting around to ripping my Blu-rays. I'm using any DVD HD to get an ISO and then Clone BD elaborate bytes to build an MKV. I'm noticing that the default Clone BD MKV size isn't far off in size from the ISO, maybe 6 to 10 gigabytes. I see it because the resulting size slider in Clone BD is maxed out. Like you, I want to have playable MKVs to near Blu-ray quality, video and audio. My question, does the small difference in ISO to MKV seem right to you, or is there, say, a formula to have Blu-ray quality MKVs at a smaller file size? This question also relates to corresponding bitrate or the MKV conversion. Also, I want to stream the movies via a NAS Plex setup in the near future. I look forward to your response." And something to remember is that the compression that is used on DVDs and Blu-rays is already lossy. So you're deciding, you know, you're deciding how much more loss you can stand.
Exactly. It isn't going to be any better than the raw data on the disk in terms of the bit rate, like he mentioned. And also, too, for color information and things like that. Now, he's talking about ISO files and MKV files, and those are effectively containers. These types of files can have any number and different type of files within them, nicely wrapped up in a single file. And in the case of a lossless archive, well, if you're not changing the compression, you're not changing the resolution or the bitrate or anything, the file sizes should be pretty similar between just a raw ISO, in a sense, just a disk copy, versus something that's been wrapped up into an MKV. You're effectively dealing with about the same amount of information in both places, both formats. So it's not surprising that the files are about the same size. Tools like Handbrake are great if you want to experiment with different encoder configurations, and if you want to make a smaller file size, something has to be sacrificed. So you're either going to nuke the resolution, the bitrate, or perhaps the color compression, or some combination of that. And usually I find if you're looking to just save file size, doing a Blu-ray movie to 720p is one quick and easy way to do it. But again, the nice thing is with a free tool like Handbrake, it might not be the fastest process in the world, but at least you can experiment with different resolution settings, bit rates, see what's acceptable for the target platform, be it your smartphone or 100-inch projected image on a screen. And realize, too, that it's a bit of an art form to be able to come up with something where you can save significant resolution, but and the trade-off isn't annoying or just something that's obvious. Like, you would hate, I think, to take the pristine nature of a Blu-ray and then say, especially a dark scene. Dark scenes are harder to compress, it seems, on most video standards I look at or systems. So if you don't want to, if you're not seeing any blockiness in the video now, and then after you apply your tweaks, you are, that might just be the way it is, or you're just going to have to either live with it, or you're going to have to make some resolution trade-offs or something like that in order to really reduce a file size. I want to say I always just did resolution. It was always number one. And then you stick to a fixed bitrate, usually lower than the native bitrate of the file. Mm-hmm. And again, going back to something like Handbrake, they provide lots of presets for you to try. For like a mobile setup or something like that. Because generally, especially the smaller the screen gets, you won't need the full resolution anyway. The pixels are just too damn small to fully appreciate. I say that now. I'm like, well, you know, sometimes it's nice having the extra resolution on a high-density display phone. But still, yeah, something must be sacrificed if you really want to squeeze a file down. And that's the beauty of Blu-ray. It's like 40 megabit, 50, 60 megabit per second. And there's a lot you can do with that in terms of minimizing artifacts, preserving fine detail, especially in complex or fast moving scenes. That's where a lot of compression tools will choke a little bit, they require a lot more processing if you're suddenly restricting the bitrate and it's a very complex type piece of video.
Almost any explosion, or particularly fiery explosion.
I find camera flashes are some of the worst, too. Just about any time on TV, especially live broadcasts, if you see a flash, somebody took a picture and the flash goes off,
right?
It'll go completely blocky, and it's very obvious.
I was going to say, I still think my favorite for the thing that really stands out in terms of a scene that makes it obvious just exactly how much you can screw up video through compression is the final racing scenes in the 2008 Speed Racer.
Oh.
Because that came out when HD over the or HD from satellite was just coming, and I remember watching it on DirecTV, and it literally turning into like 8-bit graphics.
And that's high speed motion, very saturated color palette too in that movie. So those are difficult things to reproduce at increasingly lower bit rates usually. And so
you want to tune your compression, I think, unless you are obsessed with saving drive space. You want to tune your compression so that your maximum compression does not screw up the most difficult scenes to render while compressed.
And that's the nice thing, at least in Handbrake, some of the presets are a good place to start, and then you can fine tune them to your taste if that's where you want to go. Personally, I'm kind of done with all that. It's very rare I'll ever down convert a video into a more compressed file unless I just have to have it on my phone or something like that. Otherwise, it's on my local NAS, and I'll pull it from there and play it accordingly. So for that, when it gets to the NAS point, that's like suddenly storage space is not the issue. So it's like, why? If you don't have to compress something, don't. Or further compress it. It's always a good thing, I will say.
Matthew Lawrence, a.k.a. Leo Wyatt, tweets, best value OLED this year, BC, E7, or A1, or EZ952?
Ooh, Panasonic, that EZ952. That would be a beautiful display to look at. I don't even know if that's available in the United States, but since LG makes all of these panels, and they're going to be able to offer the best value, and that their B and C series are at that end of the value line as far as their OLED technology goes. So those should continue to be, for the 2017 models, similar to last year. I think the B was the most affordable TV, B series, for 2016. And I predict it might very well be again for 2017. I believe the B series for this year has a max screen size limitation up to, I think, 65 inches. If you wanted something 77, I don't know. I think you're going to have to at least go to the C series. And I'm not even sure if there is a 77-inch C series yet. So anyway, the nice thing with the LG TVs, too, it doesn't matter on this year. All of the panels are using effectively similar technologies for the entire lineup, be it from the wallpaper, the beautiful $20,000 77-inch wallpaper TV, on down to the B and C series. They're all effectively using the exact same OLED panels, chipsets, and you should be seeing similar image quality no matter which model within the series you go with. So, but I cannot see that Sony or Panasonic or any of the many other companies that are using LG's OLED panels in their own TVs are looking to go cheap. They're looking to make premium displays, and LG is going to fill in the more value line, I think. Now, this time next year, we may have some new competition from other manufacturers besides LG related to OLEDs you can buy here in North America, at least, if not other places already. So I think next year is going to get kind of interesting, and probably more of a OLED will become more of a something people can afford as far as value goes. Because not everyone, everyone wants OLED, but some of those models are quite pricey. They're not cheap TVs.
Bordering on brutal.
And as we talked about in episode, I think, 49, they're difficult to manufacture. The environments they're created in, the tolerances for, having even one pixel fail, contamination, things like that, have just made them tough to build displays, but looking at it this year compared to last year, the selection and the sizing, it all seems to be more filled out than I've ever seen it before. So, and just the very nature of all these other companies using the LG panels for their OLED designs. And there's good options there. I would like to say, hey, it doesn't have to be LG, but I can't realistically see anyone else using an LG panel and making it cheaper than LG's doing it. I don't think that's a race you want to get into. Not against LG. Heck no.
Oh my goodness. At Eric Lott asks how to get started with starting upgrading TV speakers. I have zero audio setup for TV, small budget, start where, willing to invest over time, but really want something better than TV speakers soon. What's the first thing to spend money on that will help me build long term? Goal being a full system, but can't do it all at once.
Well, I've always used whatever I have on hand, if due.
Yeah.
Like old PC speakers are great. Don't throw them out. Yeah. You never know. Some of them included a little sub in the two channels, and you can just wire that directly into the panel in the back of the set. Done. And you might not have to do anything for that. Again, like if I have I have a Bluetooth speaker laying around, and I hate the speakers built into my TV. They're horrible. They're difficult to hear. I have to turn it. I'm constantly adjusting the volume to hear everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll take that Bluetooth speaker and link it to the TV and done. That's another way to do it. Correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think if your eventual goal is an AVR, go for a good, maybe a really good, inexpensive AVR now so you can start testing out new speakers
buying
speaker pairs and things like that slowly build your way up to the full system.
You know, it's funny. It depends on...
But on a budget, I don't blame you for not wanting to use the TV speakers. But
yeah, no. You know, I mean, the
you could probably get a used set of PC speakers, too, for...
We got to find them.
And
all due respect, like, you know, we've heard some good PC speakers.
I mean, just compared to what's built into TVs.
Yes, but there were also a lot of TV. There were a lot of PC speakers that were just as atrocious.
That's true.
As
too.
Anything built into a TV, and I
decent PC speakers. I'm thinking.
I've
worked for enough companies that always bought those Dell systems, so we ended up with all those little Dell champagne glass style speakers with a sub. I've connected those to TVs so often that I have a new respect for that. Actually. Especially the sub side of it. Just even a modest sub can add a lot to the listening experience. So.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, right?
Soundbar, I guess, is the other super
cheap
way.
That's what I was going to say. It's like when you start looking at audio, and especially if you don't have a lot of money, you know, the first step is like Robert's saying, almost anything will be a step up over the speakers and the TV. Right, because the speakers in the TV are an afterthought, and they may be a nice afterthought in a $3,000 television, and they may be an okay afterthought in a $1,000 television. But the vast majority of televisions out there, you know, HD, 4K, whatever, the speakers suck. And you may not realize it if you've never listened to your, you know, movies or television on anything other than television speakers. But as soon as you put a decent set of speakers over there, you'll kind of look at the television and be like, really? You gave me that screen and those speakers. But you're buying the screen, right? But when you're talking about an entry-level AVR, you know, like a Denon AVR 720, S720, you know, which is $350. And let's say you want to start with a set of ELAC debut speakers, which are a fantastic entry-level speaker. You know, might not be the most living room friendly, right? Because you're going to need to put them on stands, and you know, and they're speakers, they're bookshelf speakers. Those are $278 a pair.
The nice thing, at least, I see about the new AVRs out right now, we seem to be past that 4K hump, where it seems most of even the most affordable AVRs out there.
Yeah, $350 AVRs had 4K
switching
for several years.
HDR, and that's such a nice way to connect all your gear through one cable, literally going to the display.
Right there, you're looking at $630. On Amazon for an AVR and a nice set of speakers. And ideally, you would pair those with a subwoofer, right? And that'll easily take you up to around $1,000. So let's, you know, my thought would be like, and you could start with the stereo speakers, then add a center channel, and then add a rear surrounds. But I would say, you know, stereo speakers, and unless they're full range, and you're probably not buying full range speakers, and certainly not for $278, you know, but stereo speakers, then a subwoofer, then a center channel, and then surrounds, right?
That sounds like a plan.
That's kind of like the plan. You know, between now and then, you know, what you're basically going to do is save money. You know, so yeah. Keep an eye on garage sales. There are some amazing speakers, you know, from
the '70s
and '80s. And there's a lot of crappy speakers, especially from the '80s. But
I mind Craigslist too every now and then, just for a local quick pickup. It's like, I need to get rid of this today.
Yeah,
I'll be right over.
You know,
hold the door.
A quality set of, Craigslist can be an amazing resource because what somebody may be like, oh, this won't do Dolby. You know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Well, you know what? If it's an AVR and it'll take the HDMI, 1080p HDMI, you know, and do any type of Dolby, it's a step up over what you're doing right now. So if somebody's selling some surround sound speakers, you know, buy a used set of gear. Buy a sound bar.
Yeah.
You know, a Vizio sound bar is going to cost you
couple hundred bucks.
Yeah.
I think it starts for just the soundbar for like the 38-inch one is like 140. Something pretty reasonable. Probably even better on sale, but I like the ones with the wireless subs.
The 38-inch Vizio 2.1 soundbar is like 150 bucks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, here it is. The Vizio SB3 821C6 38-inch 2.1 channel soundbar with wireless subwoofer, $168.91.
I've installed those. They work great. And you know, the sub isn't horrible either. I mean, it's, you know, it is what it is. But it adds that nice low-end kick that you normally don't get with most sub bars or sub sound bars. So,
you know, and that might, you know, and then, you know, start with, you know, hit the garage sales, hit Craigslist, buy a set of, you know, buy a sound bar. And that sound bar is a really good, you know, pretty amazing deal for what it is. Buy the Vizio sound bar. And then start saving your money. And because the one thing that's guaranteed is as we move forward, more interesting stuff's going to come down and be more amazing for less money.
True. Yeah, I think with speakers, if you know exactly what speakers you want, you could start collecting those whenever you're ready. Yeah. But the soundbar is probably the cheapest way to go. And if you're dealing with something like a wall-mounted TV, they make great affordable brackets to actually hang that soundbar directly on the TV itself. And you can get those for like $15 to $25 for a set of brackets to put it on there.
Yeah.
And it makes it look good and helps clean up the keep the speaker aiming in the right direction all the time, which is
useful. I would start with that, and then I would start saving my money towards a discrete AVR. You know, this year the Denon AVR S720W is like a great entry level receiver. And when I say entry level, it may carry you for years.
I'm still using my old Yamaha, still kicking, and it does what I need it to do. It's not dealing with, you know, in our living room, we don't have 4K displays yet.
Well, that AVR 7, that's like our 1080p room. Was like almost $500 when it first came out. Now it's $350.
And, yeah.
You know, it has just about everything you need except for, say, Atmos or something. You know, and that's...
That's the upgrade down the road when you're ready for that.
Yeah, that's a ways out.
if you're going to be pushing that many speakers, then you can start thinking maybe more separates.
More separates. Yeah, you know, it gets, you know, start with a soundbar, start with stereo speakers you got at a garage sale, and then save up your money towards having a discrete AV receiver and really, really nice speakers. Yeah.
Indubitably.
Oh, and let me make it clear that Denon AVR S720 does support two-channel DTS:X and Atmos.
Two-channel? Nice.
Yeah. Not going to get all four, but no, you're paying $350.
Yeah. The decoding is there.
It can do the thing. Gail on Twitter asks, what 65 or 75-inch LCD 4K set would you recommend? And I think we covered that pretty heavily last week.
Probably.
But since this is a home theater podcast...
It really depends on your budget, number one. It's like that's kind of an open-ended question without knowing how much you're willing to spend.
If you want to spend all the money, LG's OLEDs.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that will always be. If you have a $4,000 budget for a 65-inch screen, it'd be really difficult for me to tell you not to look at the OLEDs because that's in your budget there. But when you start getting up into 75-inch screens or so, the best one I could think of off the top of my head would be Sony's X940E. Mm-hmm. $5,500 for that 75-inch panel, 10-bit panel, probably some of the best video processing I've seen on TVs in a long time. HDR, super bright. The 930E is simply the 65-inch and I think the 55-inch and maybe even one smaller panel. But for whatever reason, the 75-inch becomes, instead of a X930E, they just named it the X940. But if I had to pick a 75-inch TV, and it's not going to be the $20,000 wallpaper series OLED, at least, or that an OLED period, that's what I'm looking at, just in terms of brightness, color, good backlighting, full I believe the 940E is full array local dimming. Now if your budget is in that $4,000 range, again, like we were talking about a $3,800 65 inch 2017 OLED right now, on sale you can even get it for less. Now, if say like half that budget, $2,000 for a 65-inch screen, again, I'd glance over at Sony's X900E. Just a terrific value, terrific performance, edgelit system, yet still delivering decent HDR performance, including relatively good, compared to other edge lit systems, relatively good control of the backlight in a dynamic backlighting system. Not full array local dimming, edge lit local dimming, but among the systems I see doing edge lit local dimming, this seems to be a little more effective. And like I was saying, $2,000 right now for the 65-inch version and significantly less for the 55. But if you're looking at 65 or larger, it's also, anytime we talk about screens that big too, I'm always got to throw the shout out to projectors in general. Something you might want to consider too, because for this kind of money, you could really get a really nice projector in that $2,000 to $5,000 budget. You have many options, including the screen. So I'm thinking that's pretty good. Let's see what else out there. I probably look over it, at least the M and the P series from Vizio as well. And likewise, if your budget's nowhere near any of this, you got to keep it like under $1,000 or something like that.
TCL.
For 60. Yeah, seriously, go check out that P series. I don't know if you can get the 65 for, I think it's $1,100 or $1,200 for that.
But it's close. I mean, yeah. The 55 inch, the least expensive 4K HD TV worth buying is the P series from TCL.
Yeah, that's a pretty, I mean, especially with the Roku system. Roku built in.
If you got, it's like, yeah, it's if you've got $500,
probably my favorite thing on that TV
for the 55 inch TCL, find another $150 and get the P version, the TCL P series.
Yeah, I gotta say, Sony has been one of the most, as far as high performance LCDs for 2017. I'm finding it very difficult to look elsewhere. They've really come up with a great lineup. Not significantly different from last year, but just, again, like every little aspect has been tweaked and the performance is better and the video processing and light output and color performance and they're awful fun to calibrate. So I'm liking it. And they're all running all the Sony TVs anyway, run the Android TV platform. So you might have a better chance than most other TV owners than at least of getting Amazon Echo or Dot support linked to that as well, if you're so inclined.
If you're into that kind of thing.
Considering my roommate just added a Dot to the house. Oh, I just I have to be careful using the A word now. Otherwise he comes home to find strange things playing on the on Amazon service.
Or we were set strange things showing up after being purchased on his Amazon service.
Oh my.
Nothing says test of friendship like ordering on somebody else's Amazon account.
At Matrix Prime, shout us a question via the Twitters. What's the best method for getting rear audio in a home theater set up on the cheap without running in-wall audio to hide wires? Well, there's lots of ways to hide wires, and there are wires that are as close to flat as they can get them that are designed to make it really, really easy to run under carpet. If you got baseboard molding in between your amplifier and where the rear surrounds are going to go, you can do a lot by popping loose the baseboard molding, putting the thinnest wire you can get your grubby little paws on behind that, and then tacking it back up. You know, if you have,
well, if it's carpeted, you may even be able to slip it under, just tuck it. No, you just have to see what you have. And but I've run wire under carpet as well. It can leave a lump depending on how thick the wires are, but if it's going to be under like a piece of furniture that so it won't be seen at all or something like that, that's just an easy option. Otherwise, a product we've talked about before, and it may not be the best solution, but if it has to be wireless, you can skip on over to Best Buy and their Rocketfish series of universal wireless rear speaker kits. $100, easy to set up. It doesn't really give you any specs in terms of what kind of power these things are going to put out, but probably decent enough, I'm thinking, for at least surround speakers. And they use wireless technology that seems fairly robust, well-reviewed. And I like the Rocketfish guys for those kind of accessories, but
yeah, they're not.
But that's one option.
You know, there used to be Rust Sound used to make a wireless transmitter. Those don't exist anymore. If you want to spend a lot of money to get a fantastic wireless audio experience,
like WiSA?
I was gonna say you could go with like a Sonos Play Bar and a couple of Play Ones.
Rears. Hey, that, you know.
And then by the time you get the sub in there, I mean you've spent a couple grand.
It would sound delightful.
It would sound delightful.
Actually, that's something I didn't even think about. Yeah, you could just totally get wireless rear channels.
You know, if you own the house, I think you could play around with
a couple
which
of Play Ones.
Is not ideal for surrounds, but would definitely work. You could do ceiling mount. You could ceiling mount a couple of in-wall speakers as your rear surrounds. Technically not 100 or 90 degrees, you know, to the right and left directly, or direct, you know, basically, you know, 90 degrees from the screen to the direct right and left of the primary seating position, because they would be above your head, not to the right or left. But, you know, they have in-wall speakers that actually have the ability to tilt a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
So you can put the in-wall speakers and, you know, behind your position and tilt them towards you, which is, if you're not going to run wires through the wall, you're probably not going to cut holes in the ceiling. So I'll just walk away from that suggestion. Sorry. I got enthusiastic. But, yeah, the Rocketfish wireless rear speaker kit's one of the easiest way to do that, and they're pretty easy to find.
And they've been around for a little while, too, so.
Jake at Get Back Up Again 1 sent us a tweet. Finally got a Blu-ray player, Xbox One S. Any recommendations for the first disc? Don't have 4K TV yet, though.
Ooh.
Well, man.
Ultra high def Blu-ray looks great. The color difference is what's really
amazing. See a color difference on his standard 1080p television?
No. Okay. No.
It's like, I don't...
So if you don't have the 4K TV yet, stick to... Yeah. That's a tough call. A Blu-ray is going to look fantastic.
Yeah.
A regular Blu-ray.
I mean, what's your favorite Blu-ray? Just grab your favorite Blu-ray and put that in there.
I'm trying to think of,
I got to say, Rogue One looks really amazing on a projector.
I might have to get around to watching that sometime. I still haven't.
You know, before we get to the end of the show, have you watched John Wick or John Wick 2 yet?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
He may have real life because,
I need to verify where these discs are. I did a major cleanup in the viewing room. And I found just about every disc but that. And I know it's in a pile there somewhere. So I have various bags just filled with discs, and I'm just going through everything, cleaning it back up.
Oh, my goodness.
No excuses. God, I just got to watch that.
I mean, there's so many good movies.
The Planet Earth discs are always awesome.
Yeah.
They look great. It's pretty mellow content. I mean, personally, man. I'm thinking of Ultra High Def Blu-ray, but... God, it's just something you want to watch.
Yeah.
Repeatedly.
I mean, you know.
Visually speaking?
I mean, The Matrix looks amazing on Blu-ray.
It certainly does.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou looks. Any movie.
Actually, you know what? Serenity. Was that the movie that they released?
Yeah.
Because that was one of the first that was done with a true, full DCI workflow. That was like a special test case they were using that movie for. So that would be if you like that kind of content.
If you're a brown coat.
Yeah. Hey, fine.
If you like Joss Whedon movies. Speaking of Joss Whedon movies.
Find what you like. That would be my for a first disc.
Oh my.
Otherwise,
goodness.
I'd throw out something like there, like go grab that free AVS HD 709 disc and burn that to a CD or DVD or whatever. Slip that in and just make sure your setup's all good to go.
The Avengers.
Oh. I was going to say like Deadpool. Probably
Deadpool. Love just, Deadpool. But I'm anything by the Coen brothers?
The ultra high def looked really
good. I mean, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I know I said that one already. I mean, it depends on what kind of movies you're into. But I mean, you know, Moulin Rouge. Such an incredible movie to see.
Anything that you've also wanted to listen to? Because that's the other thing. The bitrate for the audio on these discs is outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, the format, I mean, like raw wave can go up to like 26 megabytes per second. It's just stupid. Megabytes or megabits? I'm always getting that backward. Probably megabit.
Probably megabit.
Still, it was a lot of data flying. When you consider like a DTS HD master audio track or Dolby True HD master audio or DTS:X track is around, I want to say 5 to 7.
I will say Mbps. In honor of Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, which is the latest film by Luc Besson, I will have to say The Fifth Element.
Yeah. That's been remastered enough times to where they finally unscrewed it.
Oh, God.
Another good movie. That's just, see, whatever. Those are all awesome. I'm trying to look for visual spectacle.
You know, we were talking about Joss Whedon before, The Avengers.
Okay.
You know? Iron Man 3,
especially
Iron Man 1.
The newer titles, too. That especially if they were promoting a 4K release. Because you know that 2K downsample is going to look pretty good, too.
I got to say, the Kung Fu Panda movies look really amazing.
I like it. I do. Ah, Starship Troopers. That's the only disc. That's it. There you go. That's the first one. I think I have watched that more times than... Almost any other movie.
Mic drop. There you have it.
It's the one title you need.
Oh, my goodness. You know, Something I've been meaning to mention. I had to hear these earlier this year. Then I heard the beginning at Can Jam down in L.A. In terms of like, you got $20, buy a set of Monoprice 8323 headphones. They're DJ. Wait, let me get the name on this right, because I always get it wrong, and it's still one of the funniest things I've ever.
A good starting point.
The premium hi-fi DJ style over-the-ear pro headphones with mic. Now the mic's been added since I bought my first pair. There's like three pair of these floating around my house. They cost $16. I do not know how they get this much direct from Monoprice. It costs $16, or like $25 if you get them on Amazon. The next step up for me on this is a Sony MDR-7506.
Right.
I do love the highs so much on Grado's SR80, as which was a little more low end than that headphone. But you got $20, you need a set of headphones, or you got $20 and your kids keep breaking stuff. These are pretty hard to kill. Monoprice 8323, $16 from Monoprice. Stepping up Sony MDR-7506, Grado SR80, stepping up from there, there's a whole bunch of options as you get up towards $300. And the things start to narrow again as you get closing in towards, there's not a lot of headphones, I think, that are a big jump between $350, $400 and like $1,000. But two that come to mind, you guys have heard me talk about AudioQuest Nighthawks. A lot of people don't like those because they consider them too dark. That's an audiophile phrase, right? It's dark. Sennheiser's HD 600 is dark.
Not and bright.
There are some people, possibly myself included, that think dark is a way of saying, I want the bright, sparkly MSG experience of an over-attenuated high-end because it makes me feel like I paid for more. And I get that. And I'm going to get slapped next time I show up at a HeadFi meeting for saying that. But I did. But there's a lot of quote audiophile unquote headphones that have a tremendous emphasis on the high end because it does some things to open things up and it makes them feel particularly fabulous. And I think that goes back to the early days of high end headphones, because for so many years there was no low end on headphones and there was no high end. Then they started making a high end, and later on they started actually getting the low end, the bass down. But those Nighthawks are pretty amazing, although some people consider them a little too dark, and I understand where they're coming from, especially if you A-B them back-to-back. What is probably neutral may sound dark when you've played it next to a headphone with a lot of sparkly treble. And it's hard to listen to a headphone. You can learn a lot from a headphone in 3 minutes, but you probably haven't learned nearly everything. But one of the most amazing headphones I've heard this year is Mr. Speaker's Aeon. And that's selling for about $800 now. And what gets me really excited about these is Mr. Speaker and Odyssey are two companies that kind of started as enthusiasts and became planar magnetic manufacturers, and in two very, very different ways. But what's really crazy about Mr. Speaker's is they've got like the Ether Flow, which is their sealed planar magnetic, and the Ether C, I guess the current one is the Ether C Flow. And these are like, $1,800 headphones. And what's mind-boggling to me is this company, Mr. Speakers, Dan Clark, goes from producing what's one of the finest sealed headphones I think ever made for $1,800, which sounds like a lot of money, and I get it, it is. And then they turn around and they come out with the Aeon, which may actually be better. It's at least as good as the Ether C Flow, and it costs half the price.
There you go.
Less than half the price. And I talked about this earlier this year, when I heard Mr. Speaker's electrostatics for the first time. As I was putting him on, he was talking to some other people in the room, and he said, look, we're trying to make a statement. And the statement is that, electrostatic headphones don't need to cost $50,000, because they were looking at producing those for about $3,000, maybe less. And, I get that that's a lot of money where it's $3,000 or $50,000. But when you have a $3,000 headphone that is running and taking names and kicking ass with an $8,000 headphone, that's a pretty amazing experience. The Ether C's, which are their sealed planar magnetic, sell for about $1,500. The Ether C Flow sells for $1,800. And then the Aeon, which I think is as good and possibly better than either one of them, is $800. And
that's going to open it up to a lot more people.
Yeah.
I personally hear like anything over $1,000 for headphones, at least at this point in my life. And I'm like, I'd rather spend that. That's not my priority. So I'd be looking at more value line on that.
But yeah.
I am not the headphone enthusiast that some of my friends are, but I can't help but try on every pair I'm handed and revel in the delight.
I try to keep it. I mean, another one like, Odyssey's Sign, which is like $449, with a standard audio cable, $500 with their lightning cable. That's a pretty amazing headphone. Because my ears are so large, it is not as comfortable for extended listening sessions, but it is unbelievable the amount of sound they get into this little tiny folds flat, easy to travel with headphone. I probably should be traveling with those in my bag.
There you go.
They're a little less comfortable because of my giant ass ears. But if you get a chance to audition Mr. Speakers Aeon, do it if you're looking to make a jump, because you're not getting anything better than that until you spend $1,500 to $2,000 to $2 million.
All the money.
And I just want to give a shout out to Mr. Speakers.
That's cool.
Anybody that wants to deliver me the same or better audio quality for half the price has my love and affection. I'm just saying.
Excellent. Oh, you'd be pleased. I picked up I needed to pick up a serial to USB adapter. I used it for the longest time for JVC projectors in particular for doing, I think, the firmware update. I forget what. You needed a serial connection. Or maybe that was just for the color profile, and then for the firmware, you actually used an Ethernet. Oh, it couldn't be any more crazy. But anyway, I still needed that USB to serial connector. And lo and behold, I get a hold of the new QLED series from Samsung, and they have incorporated a feature I've been wanting for a long time, and that's an auto-cal function. With the right software, you can link your PC and that software to that TV and have it directly control settings. So you don't have to dive into menus and things like that. You can do it literally through drop-down menus in the software. Super convenient, but to make the data connection to the TV between the PC and the TV, you would think it would just be maybe Wi-Fi, Ethernet at the very least. No, I'm back to that serial cable again, and I had to go buy something that converted serial to 1/8-inch mini jack, and that plugs into the audio port on the front of the TV. And some in there is where the trigger is. So I'm like, this USB to serial connector I now keep with me everywhere, this dongle, just seems to have an endless life at this point. Between the JVC projectors and now the Samsung TVs, this is just almost funny. All the other TVs I've dealt with where the software can actually get in and take control of the TV itself, generally that's just done over a standard network connection. Mm-hmm. So I'm always smiling when I got to reach for the serial to USB dongle and get that all wired up. But I was just like, wait a minute. I have to link to the TV how? Through the 1/8-inch mini jack with this crazy, thankfully inexpensive cable. But I was like, this is just a little strange.
Why am I doing this?
I'm more impressed. It's like, this isn't going to work. It works just fine. Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Kind of the calibrator's woe.
I got to say, the first episode of Game of Thrones, which is 2 weeks ago by the time you're listening to this, was...
It's begun.
It has begun.
The dragons are back. I don't even know what I'm talking about.
I know, but you're doing it really. Just what makes it so tremendously amusing. Oh, my goodness.
Excellent. I'm trying to think of what the heck I'm watching. I'm just knee-deep in baseball. Now that the halfway point or the all-star games are done... Players had a couple of days off. Now the games are back in full swing.
Oh, my goodness.
So my team's still in last place, right where they belong. But
Oakland A's!
I love them so much.
They're doing something new. They're going to pull it together at the end of the season, and they're actually going to get better during the playoffs.
Yeah.
Hey, man.
I will keep that thought in mind.
Dad said if you're going to dream, dream big.
Be positive.
You screw up and actually get what you dreamed about.
Keeping my optimistic thoughts rolling.
For example, it is. The Ether C flow... which is the top line seal, the $1,800.
Oh, $1,800.
The Aeon basically has all of the features of the technology from the Ether C flow for less than half the price.
Well, that the development cost that went into that higher-end product probably is now trickling down to some fantastic value.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, relatively speaking, if you're in this category of, God, I like that, but $1,800 is out of my price. $1,800 or $800 suddenly is...
is nearing.
Yeah.
You can save for that.
You may already be there.
I mean, that was one of the interesting things about talking to Dan Clark, and you heard me interview Mr. Theomasa Mudrum from Odyssey, is so much of the advances in planar magnetics has come from, you know, these companies figuring out more efficient ways to produce the planar magnetics and to have, you know, basically for the, you know, the manufacturing process to produce fewer fails and to reduce the amount of matching they have to do to get a set of matching drivers.
I hadn't even had that thought about headphone creation.
It's been a big deal, I think, for everybody who makes planar magnetics, is getting to the point where everything works and then everything matches. Because if you get everything that matches, you don't have to spend a whole lot of time finding two drivers that complement each other.
Makes sense.
Speaking. But with that, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to end this podcast because Mr. Heron has to be someplace on the other side of a whole lot of traffic here in the Bay Area. And as always, we enjoy, delight, and wait patiently, eagerly for your questions.
We do.
Ask at avxl.com or tweet at Robert Heron or at Patrick Norton. We'll have a whole bunch of news next week because probably things will have happened in the industry while we were hiding in various and sundry places. And
New stuff.
And
new tech.
If you enjoy the experience, you like to help pay for it, I'm going to be blunt, and you like it ad-free, because we like it ad-free, then do us a favor and go over to patreon.com/AVXL and be a part of the crew that makes AVXL possible by becoming a patron.
Totally. We don't need, like, 10 people giving us a lot of money. We'd much rather have, like, 1,000 people coughing up a buck. That's Please. Really what it comes down to. Spread out the costs.
And if you think about it, you got a friend you think would enjoy the show, share the show with them.
Buck a month.
so little. So much.
Get
so
that
little.
Early access
oh my
to our
That's
awesome
right.
production.
There is early access and hangouts and stuff.
Oh, that
like
too.
That
too.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Heron.
And we will catch you next week on AVXL.